Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. Glad you're with us. On this edition of the program, two guests and two topics. Later on in the hour, an in-depth discussion around government acquisition with Greg Wenzel of Booz Allen Hamilton. His firm has just finished a survey of government employees who work in various stages of the government acquisition process. The conclusion, in a nutshell, the acquisition process is in serious need of more integration, both within government and between government and industry. More on that later. First up, though, we get an update on DOD's long quest to begin using commercial mobile devices for day-to-day mission use. The department's been conducting a series of pilots with devices like iPhones and Android handhelds for several years. That work is starting to move out of the pilot phase, with final security approval for the department's first Android device expected within the next few weeks. John Hickey is the Mobility Program Manager at the Defense Information Systems Agency. He talked with me about the status of DOD's mobile programs at the 13th Annual C4ISR and Networks Conference.
What we're trying to do is every 90 days, we come out with another release of a capability and package it up. And so we released 1.0 in January, end of January, and that supported Apple devices. So, again, and what you'll see soon is, you know, future support for Android, specifically the Knox, Samsung Knox capability, because that's something we have a STIG on, an implementation guide. It's something we work through the security requirements guideline. It's also been through NIAP testing. So, again, it's gone through all the security pieces, and we're close, and that's coming out in the future, as well as a gateway capability where we can route traffic back through our IA sensors, information assurance sensors, and more mobile apps. So you'll see more of the flavor. In our initial release, we went with 16 base apps. That doesn't sound like a lot, because we're vetting the apps. We're vetting the code. We're looking at the apps from what they do on the enterprise capability. And so when you see in the future, you'll see the Apple piece. You'll see more apps coming in that we've looked at, kind of what we call recreational apps as well as productivity apps. And you'll see the same thing coming through on the Samsung in the future as well. So,
out of the apps that you have so far and those that you're targeting, would you say that they're primarily, you know, purpose-built for government, or are they things that you would see in the commercial version of the Apple App Store, for example?
You'll see more of the commercial version. The GOTS piece, why we're down here talking to this group, is a lot of that is still being developed, and our goal is to pull that in from the Army and the other services that have already done the mobile app piece. And as I stated, you know, DISA, along with DOD CIO, is looking at the governance and the vetting of that and how we accept that and put it within our app store that's out there. And so right now, in the at least in the coming release, you'll see a lot of the COTS. You'll see some initial GOTS apps. But we want to leverage what commercial technology has already provided. And many of our users want the same look and feel that they have on their own devices. So how do we do that with a government-furnished device? That's kind of our initiative and our first, if you will, next 90-day spend that is close to being released.
Right. Knox in particular, I think, uses this containerized approach where you have government information and government work being done inside this secure container, and then you've got another persona that can sort of access the commercial world, if that's a good way to put it. If that's the case, I mean, presumably you could download the Dropbox app or whatever your email app is that you use on your personal phone and use it on the government device, right? So you don't necessarily need to do those business apps in a DOD-specific way. Is that fair?
I think it's somewhat fair, but I would tell you we're always worried about what goes on that device. So
sure,
we do have the container, and we have waited for the Android release until the Knox container was available. We could procure it and field the capability and, more importantly, look at the security. So I think the initial Knox release, you'll see where we're working to put apps within that Knox container. Those are what we call productivity apps. And the apps on the outside of container, we're still going to control through our app store, because there's a lot of malware out there on the Android side, and we're not just going to let any app on that device, whether it's inside the container or outside the container. So inside the container, tight control. Knox has got very good, strong security. We've looked at it. Again, we've been working this for quite a while. We've actually worked with Samsung to update the Knox STIG as we're moving towards fielding. And I think on the outside, you'll see apps that users are used to, but you may not see many of the same 5,000 to 10,000 apps. We don't want the device cluttered with that. Every day you'll see something in the news with a security vulnerability associated with a certain app. Again, we're going to watch that. We're going to look at the device in whole. But yes, we do feel that the container is a strong approach. And the beauty of this container is it's built by the OEM or the manufacturer of the device. So you get a large company sustaining that capability, right? Yeah. Which is a big win. And I think not only a win for DOD, but a win for the federal government.
Just to clarify the piece you said a moment ago about device approvals, I just want to be clear. Samsung Knox, the operating system, has an active STIG as of now, but there is no Android device that has an active STIG so far. Is that right?
Well, so I think Samsung is an Android device, so I think we could be splitting hairs there, but I do believe there is an Android device that has an active STIG. It just happens to have a Knox container built in with the security piece on that, but it's using a secure Android build from an operating standpoint. And so I think it has secure Android plus a container from my perspective. So
not to split hairs too much, but is there an Android device that you can that is authorized for use inside the Defense Department right now, or is that what you're working toward?
That's what we're working toward, and that's what that Knox solution brings with that Knox, Samsung, STIG in combination together as a package. Because, again, part of our concern is the bloatware that comes on these Android devices, whether it's put on there maybe by a manufacturer or maybe it's put on there by a carrier. And then every carrier has a flavor that they may want to put on there. So we need to mitigate some of those threats that are associated with that. We don't want necessarily our information stored in an area or in a cloud that when it's official use only type information. And so we can control that with the Knox container as well as the mobile device management capability and the mask. You put that in combination. You can give them the flavor on the outside of the container. You can control the inside of the container, and you can control the activities on the device. So
I know one of the really important objectives here is to get these approvals turned around quickly. I think you've said before you want to get inside a 30-day cycle time. You feel like you've got the processes in place or are developing them to get to that?
I think we have. At least if you look at iOS 7.1 and some of the pieces that came out there, we were able to turn those as fast as the MDM could turn those and get those in the deck to support our customers and to close vulnerabilities within that operating system. Again, the same is true with Android. You've got to have the partnership, understanding what's in beta, what's coming out, so that you can be right in line with the mobile device management capability and fielding those. So I think we are seeing that. We're planning now for, if you will, iOS 8. So those are in our cycle, and we're meeting to make sure we're ready for that. So that, again, when we went from iOS 6 or iOS 5, 6, we had some challenges. We went from 6 to 7, we were in a 90-day window. We've got to get closer to a 30-day window. So I think we have made headway, and I think industry is partnering in that area, as well as they partner with all the vendors that they produce apps, as well as control the devices and the operating system.
I know you got to run, but in our last minute here, I think everything we've been talking about so far is on the unclassified side. I think the SMEPED is finally destined for end of life this year. Can you talk a bit about what's coming behind it?
Yeah, so we have what we call DLD mobility classified capability, and we talk less about the devices now, and we talk more about the infrastructure we're building to support that. So we have over 240 customers that are using that capability today, and that has voice and email at the secret level. What's coming in the future is a second deck location for failover, as well as international roaming. And so our customers are excited about that. Again, that's due soon as well. And then you've got the capability to go to top secret in the future. And that's what we're planning and standing up that capability and working with our mission partners in that area. So, I take what we have with a single Defense Enterprise Computing Center, add the failover and redundancy so that we can have an initial release, add international roaming. Once you add international roaming, you kind of take on the same capability that the legacy SMEPED has, And again, you know as well as I that the 2G capability it's based on is going away, so we have to quickly move to that. And then by the end of the year, have initial capabilities so you can start phasing in a transition in the fall timeframe. So.
At that top secret level, are you looking at voice and data or just voice?
Voice initially. You know, many of our customers, the feedback we hear at that level would like data. That's a harder one to deliver, and we have to partner with others to deliver that.
That's John Hickey, the Mobility Program Manager at the Defense Information Systems Agency, giving us an update on DoD's commercial mobile device projects. Time for our first break, and we will change topics when we come back, spending the rest of the hour on streamlining the DoD acquisition process. Some ideas on that coming out of a new survey by Booz Allen Hamilton and the Government Business Council. We'll talk about it when we come back. This is on DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin.
Stress and pregnancy. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Researchers have found a link between greater stress and the lower likelihood that a woman would become pregnant. At the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Courtney Lynch checked the biological measure of stress in about 500 women ages 18 to 40 who were trying to become pregnant. The study followed the women for 12 months or until they became pregnant.
Higher levels of stress at the outset when they got started were in fact associated with infertility, which is the first time that's ever been shown.
Lynch says activities such as yoga and meditation can reduce stress, and she says that while they haven't yet been shown to improve the chances of pregnancy, they might be worth trying. The study in the journal Human Reproduction was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
We're back on DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Switching gears now from mobility to a much broader topic, streamlining the defense acquisition process. As I mentioned before the break, Booz Allen Hamilton and the Government Business Council just surveyed several hundred government employees about it. Here's maybe the least surprising statistic. 99% of feds who work around the acquisition system think it has serious problems. Here's some other figures, though. 43% of the respondents think the biggest problem is that there's a disconnect between the expectations of government and industry. Respondents pointed to other problems that point to a lack of integration, including the government not owning data rights and program managers not being empowered to make decisions. Greg Wenzel is a senior vice president at Booz Allen. He's our guest for the rest of the hour. He says given the huge role of technology in so many acquisitions, it's time to develop new ways of integrating major programs.
So the way to look at it is the way we've been building systems for, I've built them for the last, you know, quarter century, 25 years, right? Nothing wrong with that. The way we build them, they're platforms. We're used to either doing the, when I say we, I'm talking about the defense industrial base. We're used to, you know, building the ships, planes, slash aircraft, you know, army tanks, you know, platforms, things. And then this IT thing comes up, and I'm looking at the devices that you got that are networked, you're networking right now, and we don't seem to have that in the federal government, DOD, and specifically in C4ISR. And so what we're looking at is how do we actually get there? What's the challenge? Why is that, you know, not the case where, you know, you look at the benefit of this digital ecosystem where we all pull our mobile device out of our pocket or, you know, it could be the iPad or the iPhone or the Droid or the Razer, and they're networked and getting data and we're actually able to use that for our lives. I mean, all the things that we want to do from open table to reservation systems, things like that. The problem is around the way we've been buying things in the government, where the government has been buying. What worked for us for the last, in my experience, 25 years, but prior to that, it's been the platforms when intersecting with this IT thing, when we were doing automation on platforms, it wasn't the way it is now where IT is ubiquitous. Right. It was, you had to write assembler code, embedded software on to these tanks and things like that. But now, when you look at, you know, coming into C4ISR, if you were to say C4ISR as a weapon system, for it to be the most effective is where it's networked. But the way we've bought it is with, you know, a bunch of sensors, maybe with their own ground station, and in some cases we've done point-to-point connections of those. But it's not the approach that, you know, we're using in our daily lives called TCP/IP and the Internet. So I think that's the fundamental, and what we're finding is, can we switch it to where the government does, you know, we view there's this thing, an enterprise integrator role. Somebody has to get us thinking like an enterprise. Is it the government that takes back control, or is it industry helps the government take back control? But I would say the large-scale integrator as an enterprise integrator doesn't work. It works for platforms, maybe, but then it doesn't work for these networked IT systems where you want to buy what we call more smaller things, apps, right? And you hear all the analogies in the commercial space. How do we get there in the federal defense and then even within C4ISR?
So it works for platforms, not necessarily for networked IT systems, but these days, isn't an aircraft carrier or a fighter jet a networked IT system?
Yeah, they actually have their data links that they may use, but for example, the Joint Strike Fighter, if it has new sensor devices on it, you know, how do we know that a soldier wants to get access to a picture that thing has taken? And there's no way when you're building a soldier device that if we try to automate or get information further to the edge, how would I know how to build this mobile device that the software knows how to reach and plug in and get the information from that Joint Strike Fighter, right? So right now we're still, even though they're networked, it's what I would call point networked. It's, okay, let's just take the information, drop it to some ground station, and figure out how to disseminate it after the fact.
Right. Yeah. In your survey of folks from the acquisition community, the engineering community, et cetera, a couple months ago, one of the main findings I think you had was that there's a sense that the government needs to take back control over the acquisition process and over intellectual property on a number of fronts. Flesh out for me a little bit where you think that's coming from and what those ideas are.
Well, in the survey, what we found is that it was coming from 304, I think it was, you know, 40, right? 340 respondents that what I would interpret, and by the way, how we initiated it, we were hearing this feedback as we were having our dialogues with colleagues, industry colleagues, and government. I think what happened is that with the drawdown in resource, the new environment that we're in, there's no wartime spending where everybody is, you know, pulling cash, you know, from out of the sky. So the volume of concern starts increasing and people start communicating. So we said, well, let's see if we can do an independent find out where the concerns are coming from and how do we do something with them. And what we find is that the respondents are saying the government needs to provide more direction on how we would do this. So the earlier point about the difference between platform and IT acquisition, I believe a lot of people understand there's those differences. The problem is the current acquisition buys industrial age acquisition on the platforms versus this modular agile IT that changes every 18 months, you know. And so I think the couple points is that if the government were to provide that clarity with some type of blueprint or whatnot of if we're now buying a thing, how does it plug into the network, I think industry would be fine with that, you know, provide that direction. What we're finding is in asking the question, who should do that? You know, Is it, okay, let's give that to another large-scale integrator to define, you know, what the blueprint is? When we've seen that, when the government tried this around net centricity and think, you know, when the large-scale integrator would do that, it all of a sudden that those interfaces, the blueprints, the plugs, started looking like the APIs of their systems. So it needs to be something a little bit more independent. Could be a different, and that's where, you know, where Booz Allen is working and looking at the, helping the government be successful in taking back their enterprise.
Can an outside party of some kind serve as effectively independent, or does it really just need to be the government performing that function?
I think so. In some cases, again, Booz Allen is helping do that. In other cases where the government has the assets, the resources that actually understand this different problem and how to do it, by all means, you know, the government could insource it themselves and do it themselves. That's what, you know, we published this thing called the Enterprise Integrator. It was what we viewed the role that is required to get us to this enterprise effect, you know, in across DOD, but specifically in C4ISR, because we view, you know, C4ISR as a weapon system. If you were to use the analogy on the Joint Strike Fighter, right? If you were to buy the Joint Strike Fighter the way we buy C4ISR into separate things, you know, I'm not sure I'd want to fly in. You know, so it makes sense to have the large-scale integrator for the platforms that we will have and continue to have in the future. But when it comes to this networked IT to be the most effective, it needs to be something a little bit different. Maybe the folks that aren't bending the metal, you know, whether it's the government or industry on behalf of the government, you know, seems to be more the honest broker role to get us to this enterprise effect.
Greg Wenzel is a senior vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton. We're discussing a survey and report that firm just finished on streamlining the defense acquisition process. We'll talk more about it after another break. This is on DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin.
Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 9, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO to hear from your agency's top tech leader how technology is changing government. Tech Tuesday on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is on DOD. I'm Jared Servu. Back to our discussion with Greg Wenzel of Booz Allen Hamilton. Booz Allen and the Government Business Council are out with a new report based on a survey of several hundred defense employees on streamlining the defense acquisition process. Before the break, we were discussing the role of the government as the systems integrator on major projects and the need for the government to retake control over many elements of its acquisitions.
And when it comes to that idea of the government retaking control, owning data rights, et cetera, one of the interesting findings in your survey was that operators and engineers were much more likely to hold that view than the actual acquisition community was.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on why that
intriguing,
might be?
Intriguing, isn't
it,
that?
It is intriguing.
Yeah, so we had the same, you know, the way we structured to trying to get the operator, engineer, and the acquisition, you know, sample the three types of the people involved in this ecosystem and see where we would hear the feedback. And my interpretation of it would be that the operators, you know, the warfighters are screaming for it, you know, because they want this fully they want their iPhone equivalent in the battlefield, so I don't have to call up and, you know, maybe get something in 2448, you know, it's their real time. And then the engineers, those that are actually starting to become IT engineers, right, with the kids coming out of college now that use these devices, you know, instead of the traditional platform engineers, the IT engineers that know their system is most effective when it's networked and fully connected, they're asking for what's the blueprint for how I will plug my thing that I'm engineering into the greater ecosystem. And that's what's missing. So that's my interpretation, that there's some encouragement that, you know, both the operators and the engineers are asking for it. And maybe we have the discussion with the acquisition community. Can we buy something a little bit differently than the way we have for the last, you know, however many, you know, decades?
Right. On the specific sort of narrower issue of ownership of the data rights in you know, the acquisition of a system, where does that conversation fit into everything that we've been talking about?
Right. So the way we've seen where the government has looked at buying some shared services, some of the systems, and in the contract it may be where they will buy the system, but then the contractor owns the data rights. And I think it was a evolution of a, how do I call it, a financial model where, you know, again, industry is, you know, for profit. Some of them, many of them publicly traded, right? We're one of them. But I don't think that is the right way to try to hold hostage the data rights, because, again, IT, networked IT, it's all about the data. So who should own that? I believe we could build a system that may produce the data, but then the government owns it. If the government's paying for it, it's theirs. They should be able to reuse it wherever they want. So holding that, and I'll just call it, you know, holding the data rights at hostage, I think it's encouraging that the government sees that and says, we want to own that because it's part of their digital ecosystem that they're effectively trying to create.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me you could take that too far, though, right? Because there are cases where the data is the company's secret sauce, and you don't want to be in a position as the government of strong-arming them into giving that away.
That's a good point. You know, there's a balance, right? So the classic is, you know, the data rights, you know, industry only, only owns them, and then the government wants to take them back. I just go back to, if the government were to define the interfaces and how the information would be flowing out of the system, then you can actually have the competition that allows the innovation and you know, making money on the black box. An example would be the home entertainment industry, right? Or your home stereo. When you look at the devices, you know, there are common, call it user interface front end stuff, you know, how to turn the volume up, the play button, the fast forward button, what, right? But they're all different. They look different, you know, even though they may have those common fast forward buttons, things like that, but there's different little devices. When you turn those things around, you see the RCA jack, the HDMI interface, the things like that, that allow you to buy, and then it now plugs in and it's networked with another thing. And what happens is you're buying based on the innovation of the box, not on the interface. So, again, if the government creates those metaphorically HDMI and RCA interfaces that says, here's how I need this function, here's how it would plug in, then actually what we're going to run into is that the information will be ubiquitous and the competition won't be over the data if they have proprietary data, whatever. It'll be around the algorithms and the things that are in the black box. That's where the innovation occurs. Just, again, like our entertainment industry, you can see how it has evolved over the last 25 years because industry came together and said, we're going to agree to plug in for the greater good. And we all benefit from it. So if the government could get their equivalent, then I think that's where, you know, it may turn some folks' business model, industry business model, on its ear. But I'm sorry, you know, we got to figure out a way to do the right thing again. let's not forget who we're doing this for.
Well, right? Yeah, and if they do it right, it also seems like it would lower the bar to entry to people who aren't traditionally part of the government acquisition system.
Amen. You got it. That's the thing, is by having those interfaces, open standards, you know, that enterprise blueprint, you know, then more of industry can compete, and the great ideas will come forward. If you have a really good idea, it's, you know, it's going to make its way through the system, and, you know, then you'll be successful. But those that, you know, will get the 5-year contract or the 10-year contract that are looking to, that's in some cases what may stifle the innovation. And, you know, maybe we need to get into the more, how do we get to this agile modular acquisition to achieve this agile modular enterprise?
That's Greg Wenzel, I'm a senior vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton. We're talking about integrating the government's acquisition process and a new survey and report they've just finished on that topic together with the Government Business Council. We'll wrap up with one more segment after a break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin.
Stress and pregnancy. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Researchers have found a link between greater stress and a lower likelihood that a woman would become pregnant. At the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Courtney Lynch checked a biological measure of stress in about 500 women ages 18 to 40 who were trying to become pregnant. The study followed the women for 12 months or until they became pregnant.
Higher levels of stress at the outset when they got started were in fact associated with infertility, which is the first time that's ever been shown.
Lynch says activities such as yoga and meditation can reduce stress, and she says that while they haven't yet been shown to improve the chances of pregnancy, they might be worth trying. The study in the journal Human Reproduction was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Did you know there are hundreds of government and military events happening right here in the D.C. metro area? Check them out by visiting govevents.com. Easy to use and free to join.
Welcome back to On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DoD. Wrapping up our show this week with a few more thoughts from Greg Wenzel, a senior vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton, talking about their new survey and report on integrating the defense acquisition process. Before our last break, he told me the government needs to take more charge of the integration function in major programs as one way to reach the goal of more modular, more agile acquisitions.
It seems like there are a couple examples of really big programs where that is happening, where the government really is focusing on integration, defining the interfaces, as you've been saying. The Navy's CANES comes to mind.
Right.
I think you could probably say some similar things about D6A and the Army. Yeah. I mean, are those exceptions to generally what's going on right now, as you're smiling.
Right, you get it. Those are the exceptions to the rule, and I think if there's a way for those programs and the government advocates and stakeholders over those, the Navy IT Tech Authority, Admiral Rodman, right, you know, how do we get integrated interoperability across the Navy and what he's trying to do with his team creating the blueprints? The DI2E, Defense Intel Information Environment, USDI, and DI, right? I think there's some case studies where you could see there were some programs that were anticipating, even prior to the budget drawdown, the need for this. Now that the drawdown has occurred, they're becoming more visible, and people are turning to those programs and view each one like that HGMI standard, or that, you know, then you see industry switching and go, oh, all right, can we get those faster? Where is the blueprint that, again, with DSIG's Army, you know, we were working with them since 2005, where they had some vision that said this war spending is not going to continue. They were trying to achieve interoperability of the 9 programs of record, each doing their own INT. But when they had the open architecture, the government took back control, created that blueprint, then they actually found it created that competition. had a whole bunch of new industry participants that were able to play and provide a piece of the puzzle. And now it's this integrated thing that really, you know, it has provided Intel 10 times what they had 10 years ago, you know, with all these individual stovepipes.
So what did they do right? I mean, how did they bring all those things together? Is it just a leadership issue? Somebody's got to step forward and say, hey, guys, we're going this way?
You got it. That's it. It's the leader in the government. We've seen a lot of great government advocates and, advocate is the right word for this different way to do. Army Common Operating Environment is another one by the Army CIO G6 down to Terry Edwards, you know, who's going to was an ASALT, the Army acquisition. How do we get onto these common set of platforms? And with respect to IT, right? And so I think what we're running into, we see there are people that are experienced with buying based on the platform, and then there are some folks that were either in the IT, in the government, that they saw this coming, or some visionaries. You know, I'm not sure what the pattern is there, but yes, leadership are the ones that, initiate, and can we carry these through to reality? I remember back when I was doing programming in the mid-90s, Admiral Art Sobrowski had net-centric warfare as a concept, right? I mean, that's what, you know, is saying, if we're netted, then we'll actually be able to go against this asymmetric threat. And then we tried net-centricity as an IT implementation of that in 2000-ish time frame, and then 9/11 occurred, and that was it. So now there may be another opportunity to revisit it, and it goes back to leadership from the government, just defining. As soon as when the government buys a certain way, like the D6 Army program, they transformed, and they had a lot of industry showing up at their doorstep, but the PEO, the Army G2, the PEO, they're all, that this is the right thing to do. And they adjusted their acquisition on how they were going to buy, instead of one big contract, a bunch of smaller ones, or medium size. And, the leadership carried it through. And right now it's a good exemplar of this being, done successfully in my mind.
Last thing, when people talk about the government as a systems integrator role, the question is always, well, is there enough systems engineering expertise, et cetera, on the government side? What do you think the answer is?
In some areas, there are. So there's no consistency across the board. You can't say yes or no. Mm-hmm. The example I just gave, D6 Army, yes, they had some good chief engineer leadership. Some of it was augmented by industry and the Navy. See a lot of engineering, talent. But still, they'll get augmentation from industry in that space. But the question is, who is doing that? I would say maybe someone that is actually a provider of a piece of the solution, call it the metal bending, may not be the ones that should be working with the government to define those blueprint
requirements,
right?
Yeah.
There's across all the services, we see there's engineering, Air Force, AFRL, Rome Labs, right? A lot of R&D, some good innovation engineer. The question is, can those folks, can we get to the acquisition where it starts at the top with those program Army Common Operating Environment? Is there equivalent in the Air Force and Navy? Does there need to be? Or can it roll up to the joint level? Who's defining that blueprint? Because DoD is a pretty big thing. And, it goes back to, I don't think there's going to be one. DI2E is focused on a mission. They're not going to be able to address all of DoD. But if there's maybe it starts with the DoD CIO, what the portfolio and how this thing breaks out that says, okay, this is the HDMI, we need this HDMI standard to address this type of information and data and that goes to the Army. And then this one goes to the Air Force, right? Looking at a portfolio of who's doing the print, I think that's going to be the thing that the government needs to kind of take back control, have the engineering resources. Sometimes they may let a contract to augment, but the government is in charge.
Right.
Right? They will say, this is what I want or don't. They may not have the resource, but if there's, to your earlier point, the leadership there that sees the vision of having those interface standards, whether the government does it or industry on behalf, at least the vision's there and we're all marching in that direction.
Well, Greg, this has been really interesting. Thanks for talking with us. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Greg Wenzel is Senior Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton. The discussion we've been having is based in large part on a survey and study of the government acquisition and engineering workforce, along with the Government Business Council. It's called Bridging the Disconnect. We'll link to it at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. Earlier in the program, we talked with John Hickey, DISA's Mobility Program Manager, about the current state of DOD's commercial mobile device plans. We'll post that conversation, along with the rest of this program, at that same URL. That's it for this week's show. Thanks again for joining us. Hope you'll tune in again for another edition of On DoD next week. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Check your thrift savings plan numbers every day at federalnewsradio.com. Find out how your funds closed and how they're doing for the year. It's all right there on our homepage, federalnewsradio.com.